content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. I'm going to start with an article from AARP, the magazine, under Real People, Caregiver Chronicles, A Loving and Difficult Journey, What Annette Franqui Wishes She Had Known About Taking Care of Her Mom. We knew something was wrong with my mother, but we didn't know exactly what. Raised in a big, boisterous Puerto Rican family, she had always been vivacious and warm, an involved, affectionate parent to my sister and me. But soon after she retired at age 67 from her career at a pharmaceutical company, Mom started acting differently. After decades of weekly salon visits, she let her hair grow and her nails were a mess. Her apartment in San Juan grew ever more cluttered, and she had started to withdraw. In 2014, I told her I was having surgery and asked her to come to Miami to help out for a few days, a request she ordinarily would have leapt at. "I can't," she said. "I have my dog." That was not the mother I knew. In 2015, my sister Debbie and I took her to a neurologist. After examining Mom, he told her, with the amount of levity that hurt and offended me, that she had dementia and should just go out drinking with her girlfriends. That wasn't our plan, but Debbie and I knew that we needed one. We had to figure out how we would help and interact with Mom during her illness. Although we have made mistakes along the way, we have also learned a great deal about caring for a loved one with dementia that might be useful to others starting down the same difficult path. Meet them where they are. Something I needed to learn early on was to let my mother be herself, her current self. For example, I had wanted her to exercise to preserve her muscle tone and bone strength. Mom was not on board. I would fret about how to get her to work out until my husband, Seth, said, "You're asking a person who just lost their leg to run a marathon. You can't do that. She's a different person now." I had to let go of some of the goals that I had for her. Part of letting Mom be herself was recognizing when her reality was different from ours. When someone is having a delusion because of dementia, you're not going to talk them out of it. Instead, we learned to meet Mom in her reality when we could. There's no harm in playing make-believe sometimes. It can even be a good way of connecting. Surround them with love. One of Seth's granddaughters, Gracie, was 2 years old when my mother was diagnosed. She and my mom were best buddies, so we watched Gracie growing as my mother's disease was progressing. And when Gracie was 5 or 6, the two sort of traded places in their relationship. Some might assume that exposing children to adults with brain disorders could be too confusing for the kids, but that has not been our experience. My mother adores children, and including her in family activities has been a source of delight and even magic for all of us. Divide and conquer. Debbie and I have very different personalities. I am the practical one, making sure caregivers get paid and that Mom has all the supplies that she needs. Debbie is the emotional one, more suited to taking care of Mom's hands-on care. Having different strengths is actually a blessing. You can assign rules or roles to whoever will do them best, and you have to assign roles. Coordinating care for someone with dementia, even when there are resources to pay for professional caregivers, is not a one-person job. The effort has changed and strengthened my relationship with Debbie. Although she's only 18 months younger than I am, she had always been the baby of the family, and I treated her as such. I had to learn to approach her as an equal when it came to Mom's care. No one is the boss. Lean on others. Each member of a caregiving team needs their own support system. I'm fortunate to have a great husband and lifelong friends who have my back. When I have doubts or fears, I can turn to my support system for encouragement and perspective. I don't need to burden Debbie with all of that. Then, too, I've learned to rely on the kindness of strangers. For instance, when I took Mom out, I got into the habit of identifying someone, often a mother with kids, I could ask for help from in a pinch. I would say, "Would you mind keeping an eye on my mom while I run into this restroom?" People were so kind. They say, "Yeah, I understand." And finally, cherish the time you've got. My mother's disease has progressed to the point where she doesn't talk anymore. But even now, there are interactions that let me know she's in there. Sometimes she'll squeeze my hand or she'll blow a little kiss. I'm so grateful that when Mom was first diagnosed, we encouraged her to remain as active and social as possible. She had another good 5 or 6 years of travel and family adventures. We have a lot of sweet memories from those years. Caring for a dementia patient isn't easy, and I know it's even harder if your resources are limited. Dementia is a journey you take with your loved one. You know where you'll ultimately end up. But I want caregivers to know that along with the uncertainties and sorrows, there are beautiful things to see along the way. Annette Franqui, 61, is a founding partner at Forrestal Capital in Miami. She is the former chair of AARP's board of directors. Now let's pick up with the article from AARP, the Bulletin, on the same sort of issue, fixing the caregiving system. We were up to item number 4, payment for training. Family members are often drawn suddenly and without guidance into a caregiving role, leaving them on their own to figure out how to perform a range of tasks they have never done before. A new proposal from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, would help with that, authorizing Medicare payments to healthcare professionals to train family caregivers in a range of activities, from managing medications to helping with daily living. At the highest level, I'm really excited about it, says Tara English, CEO of Givers Health, a healthcare training organization based in the San Francisco Bay Area. They are, for the first time ever, providing reimbursements for a person who is not a patient. CMS Director Mina Shashami says that family members fill a key role on a care team that includes medical professionals and social workers. We see caregivers as an important part of our overall vision for the Medicare program, she said at an AARP-sponsored Politico virtual event in December. How do we think about the people we're caring for in a broader sense? Where can we provide training and education? That is the key. A greater outreach. Most new caregivers eagerly want information and support, but navigating a maze of agencies and organizations is challenging. Federal and state programs are of little use if caregivers don't know about them. On the federal level, President Biden's national strategy includes this goal: optimize existing family caregiver support efforts by reducing redundancy, improving information sharing, and infusing best practices system-wide. This is a long game, explains Megan O'Reilly, Vice President in AARP's Government Affairs Office. And the executive order set out the directive to the federal government to start working on this stuff. On the state level, Nevada is working to gain a greater understanding of caregivers' needs. The Nevada Lifespan Respite Care Coalition, an advisory board established under the Nevada Aging and Disability Services Division, spent more than a year talking to family caregivers, service providers, state agencies, and recipients before publishing its first state plan for the support of family caregivers. The report offers 18 recommendations for state and community partners to consider when designing programs for family caregivers in three areas: collaboration, outreach, and funding. One example, respite services need to be available for purchase through a sliding scale on income eligibility so that all caregivers can purchase the service. Another recommendation, centered on outreach, notes that caregivers are reluctant to ask for assistance until they receive and reach a point of crisis. The state legislature authorized a study to access the capabilities, needs, and quality of life. This bill allows lawmakers to assess the needs of family caregivers and report back to the full legislature. In 2025, with bills to enhance existing programs, says Erin Neff, an associate state director in ARP's Nevada office. And finally, closing the inequity gap. One of the most challenging caregiving issues is dealing with income, racial, and other disparities. Take the common example of older people on Medicaid who are coping with a serious chronic disease. They wish to stay in their home, but if they are not eligible or not able to get home care, they may wind up in a Medicaid-funded nursing home. Medicaid does grant waivers that mean it will pay for in-home care, but they have been hard to get. Louisiana has seen major progress, though. It gained 500 additional slots for home and community-based services, HCBS waivers, for Medicaid recipients this year, allowing for services to be administered at home. We're chipping away at the wait list, which is pretty lengthy, says Andrew Mall, AARP Director of Advocacy for Louisiana. But if I wanted to go to a nursing home tomorrow, there would be a spot for me. He's particularly optimistic about a huge win that went into effect on July 1st, creating a trust fund that will place 12% of any excess revenue in a given budget year from the state into an account that could be used for HCBS needs. It's not a silver bullet solution, he says, but it's a sizable step in the right direction. A similar fund was set up in Louisiana for children with disabilities in 2007. That program has no wait list now. Another important action aimed at helping those who have not had access to care comes from Biden's executive order. The recently announced Medicare Dementia Care Model aims to improve the quality of life for people living with dementia by helping them remain in their homes while reducing strain on unpaid caregivers. CMS will test a new payment for participants who deliver supportive services to people with dementia. This will include care coordination, access to a helpline, and a care navigator who can help find services. Although this will affect a broad range of people, the announcement from CMS specifically noted that Black, Hispanic, and Asian Americans, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander populations have been particularly disadvantaged in receiving dementia care. This guiding and improved dementia experience guide model, running for 8 years starting in July 2024, will provide new resources and greater access to specialty dementia care in underserved populations and communities. This article was by Ann Oldenburg, a former USA Today reporter. She's an assistant director of Georgetown University's journalism program. She has a master's degree from Georgetown's Aging and Health programs. And we had one more sidebar article with this. The Faces of Caregiving, Carrie Shaw, 35, CEO of Embodied Labs. The company produces a virtual reality platform that allows people to experience what life is like with Alzheimer's and other conditions. She was a caregiver for her mother who had Alzheimer's. I became a primary caregiver for my mom when I was 23. It was just so hard for me to understand what her world was like. Why was she saying, "I want to go home"? Why was she trying to pack a bag and leave the house? Now, with my work at Embodied Labs, they, caregiver and loved one, can connect with each other and problem solve some of the most challenging things that come with caregiving. And finally, Mary Claire Figham, 69, she founded a caregiver support group in Eugene, Oregon, and is a caregiver for her husband, who has spinal stenosis, fibromyalgia, osteoarthritis, and deteriorating vision. Isolation is a huge problem with caregivers. Every one of us express gratitude on a regular basis for having this group. Each of us have learned new ways to approach difficult conversations in caregiving. There's such a great need. It would be really lovely if our government could appreciate the amount of time and energy that caregivers put in, because we're keeping our spouses alive and out of more expensive medical care. Now, in the bulletin, under the heading of Your Life, Heroes of the Forgotten War. 7 decades later, those whose lives were touched by the fighting in Korea remember. Falling between World War II and Vietnam, the Korean War, which ended in an armistice 70 years ago, has sometimes seemed to have a less vivid place in America's memory. But for those who fought in harrowing combat under brutal conditions there, the memories remain indelible, as they do for those who lost loved ones. And for those of Korean ancestry, the war marked the modern birth of a free and prosperous homeland. Here are some of the stories from that war. Salvatore Sal Scarlato, 90, from Hopage, New York. Private U.S. Marines, served in Korea from April 11, 1952 to early April 1953. He is a retired electromechanical design draftsman. My story is about hell and hatred, but it is also a story about love. An 18-year-old that goes into the military doesn't have a clue what he's getting into. He doesn't have a clue about war. He doesn't have a clue about what a bullet could do to a human body. When I first went to Korea, I said to my superiors, "Why are we going to Korea? Where the hell is Korea?" I was assigned to Baker Company, and we were headed to the MLR, the main line of resistance. We only got 3/4 of the way when we were hit with light fire and mortars. The Chinese liked to attack when it was getting dark. They would blow a horn, a bugle, and a whistle, and then attack. We jumped out of our truck. The sergeant kept yelling, "Head for the rice paddy." I started praying. Over the next many months, there were many battles. There were monsoons, rain so heavy you couldn't see in front of you. I carried a Browning automatic rifle. It weighed about 20 pounds, and the ammo belt weighed about 13. I carried all that up mountains time and again. One day, we were under heavy fire from Chinese for 24 hours straight. The guy next to me got hit in the stomach. I had just met him, and he fell on top of me. I put my hand on his belly to apply pressure, but his whole insides were blown out. This was the first, but not the last, time a fellow Marine died in my arms. In July of 1952, I was wounded in the leg, neck, and hand by a grenade. They flew me on a helicopter to a hospital ship. I thought I had a million-dollar wound because I thought I was going home. But they sent me back to my unit, back into the war. One day we were patrolling and we found civilians, South Koreans, that had been executed. There were 3 little children alive, a boy and 2 girls. The little boy, I took him to an orphanage, but he died when he got there. I felt so much hate. It tore me apart. I was sitting there crying, and the guys were saying, "Calm down, calm down." And then I saw this object, a very bright object. It spoke to me. It said, "Now you know why you're in Korea. It is to save these people." And that's all it said. Ever since, I have loved the Korean people. I felt sorry for them. They were just thrown to the wolves. I have been back to South Korea 9 times. South Korea is the only country we ever fought for what still respects and honors us today. I have got South Korea people that are my brothers. Now, for our remaining time, also in the bulletin, let's look at a Q&A answer session with David Brooks. The way to heal these great divides is one person at a time. David Brooks, the celebrated pundit, 62, has turned his gaze to America's divisions. You have talked about your mission to generate discussion about things like morality and respect, including in your new book, How to Know a Person, The Art of Seeing Others Deeply and Being Deeply Seen. What motivated this? I think as a society, we are over-politicized and under-moralized. We spend too much time thinking about politics and not enough time on the things that really matter, which are having courage and honesty, being honorable, and being capable of great love. You focus on two questions. Why are Americans sad, and why do Americans seem so mean? The statistics are horrific. Rising suicide rates, rising depression, the number of people who rank themselves in the lowest happiness category has gone up by 50%. It's a societal breakdown. When people feel invisible and unseen, they regard that as an injustice. They get angry and lash out and become mean. When did we head down that road? Probably sometime around 2000. I think it was partly accelerated by smartphones and social media. You also point to widespread loneliness. People are less likely to attend church, synagogue, and mosque, to belong to the Elks Club or the Kiwanis Club. They have smaller families. Those are some of the causes. A lot of the causes of loneliness and isolation is that people are not good at socializing. Just the act of showing respect is the first step to healing some of this enmity. You note that moral lessons are not being conveyed like they once were. There are all sorts of morally formative institutions that were very popular in American life, ranging from the Boy Scouts to the schools to the McGuffey readers. Then, sometime after World War II, people decided human beings don't need to be trained anymore in the basic skills of how to be a good person, how to listen well, how to ask for forgiveness, how to end a conversation gracefully. These are skills, just like carpentry and plumbing are skills. Americans are, of course, deeply divided. How can we start to come together? I would start with institutional reforms. Ones that I support include rank choice voting or open primaries as a way to have elections so that it's not just Party A and Party B. These angry minorities dominate everything. We need political leadership that isn't ripping the country to shreds from the top. But I focus on the bottom. I think the only way to heal these great divides is one person at a time. This is really about having conversations. My goal is to try and see the world a little bit from the perspective of the other person. Is there a dearth of adult leadership in Washington these days? My view is that there are a lot of good people here, but they are caught in a rotten system. In private, the politicians I have interviewed have been very reasonable. But when they go on TV, they look like monsters with brutal talking points. Are you optimistic going forward? If you go back through American history, it's very hard to pick a decade where we didn't have real challenges. I think we have become a fairer society. We have made progress in allowing women and minorities to use their talents to contribute more. I remain optimistic that the strength America has always had, the freedom and dynamism, those strategies are still there, and I will see us through. The 2024 election looms. What are the key issues for older Americans? People worry about Medicare and Social Security. I think those are safe. The main issue for older Americans, especially, is you want to get back a better world than you inherited. It's called generativity. Are we going to pass down a country whose democracy is not functioning, where prosperity is not widely shared? It's an existential crisis that should be of interest, especially to this generation. You're now in your early 60s. Have your ideas about aging changed over time? We have a whole new life stage. I call them the encore years. If you're retired and you're 60, you might have 20 or 30 years of vibrant life left. I interviewed one woman who was a lawyer. She retired and became a playwright. She said, "I want to do things in fields I know nothing about. I can fail big. I'm 65. Who cares?" I really admire that. You quote a psychologist who says, human beings are continued works in progress, yourself included. If you had met me 30 years ago, you would have found me a little aloof. I've learned to be more relational and humbler. I'm more in touch with my emotions, even the sad ones. But I decided at a certain middle age that I didn't want to shut myself off from life. Let's end with one of your favorite questions. What crossroads are you at in life? I'm at that moment where you step back in life and think, okay, what am I going to do with the years left? What's the big adventure that I want to have before the final curtain? And this interview was by Tom Dunkel. Now, a quick look at a few highway signs that that might be available nowadays. Slow down. This ain't Thunder Road. Visiting in-laws? Slow down. Get there late. Drive like the person your dog thinks you are. 4 is in Mississippi, 2 eyes on the road. And camp in the Ozarks, not on the left lane. This is highway humor. Roadway messages boards aren't just for alerting drivers to accidents and construction ahead. State departments of transportation have crafted some clever safety slogans too. Note, the feds frown on this practice for fear of driver distraction, so it's best that you got to hear them here. So remember, drive like the person your dog thinks you are, or maybe your cat. Well, folks, we have run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure and listen at the same time next week. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.